Welcome to World War I Centennial News. It's about World War I news 100 years ago this week, and it's about World War I now, news and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Today is March 15th, 2017, and your host is Teresa Sims.
Hi, this is Teresa Sims. I'm coming to you live from Washington, D.C. at the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission Studios. First, we're going to start our show by looking at what's happening in World War I 100 years ago this week. Over the last 3 weeks, we've been talking about problems in the seas between the Germans and the United States. 100 years ago this week, we encounter a very frustrated President Wilson, who makes a bold move to protect U.S. merchant ships. On March 13, 1917, Wilson decided that congressional approval was not strictly necessary, and he implemented by executive order the Armed Ships Bill that states that any American flag vessel which desired a naval gun could request one, provided that it would be manned by trained officers and sailors of the United States Navy. There's not just drumbeat to war here. There is growing chaos in other parts of the world. Mike Schuster with the Great War Project blog joins us to explain what was taking place in Russia.
Hi, Teresa, and thank you. The headlines could read, "All eyes on Russia. Strikes, violence, martial law hit Russian capital. The first Russian revolution begins," and this is special to the Great War Project. On March 10th, a century ago, Russia is facing nothing short of revolution. As a general strike began in Russia, writes historian Martin Gilbert, martial law was declared in Petrograd. Tsar Nicholas faces heavy pressure to abdicate the monarchy, but he resists. Violence breaks out. On these days a century ago, the Tsar is still thinking about territory he will gain for Russia when the war ends. Secret discussions are underway with the French to determine the shape of the Russian Empire. But Russia's workers and soldiers have other goals in mind. Gilbert reports, on March 12th, as Nicholas is on his way to Petrograd, the soldiers of the Petrograd garrison joined the crowds in the streets of the capital, demonstrating against him. There was street fighting when soldiers loyal to the Tsar, together with the police, sought to maintain order, but they were massively outnumbered. Soon fires break out across the city. As miseries mounted, writes historian David Stone, increasing numbers of soldiers refused to participate in the war any further. Soldiers refused to obey orders, reports Stone. Writes historian Martin Gilbert, the first Russian Revolution had begun. Historian Stone reports that the gathering tension on Russia's home front finally broke on 8th March, a century ago. On that day, marches by large crowds of women who bore the brunt of bread lines and food shortages triggered spontaneous protest strikes by men as well. Reports Stone, strikes and demonstrations grew dramatically the next day and again the next. Violence is limited, but most of Petrograd's factories are shuttered. Still, it is just a matter of time before violence shakes this capital. On March 11th, writes Stone, troops are sent into the streets and were ordered to shoot into the crowds. Several dozen people were killed. Concludes Stone, that step destroyed Tsar Nicholas's regime. Soldiers strongly resist shooting more civilians. They hold meetings on the night of March 12th. Unit after unit met and voted to disobey orders to fire on civilians. By March 13th, Petrograd was entirely out of government control. In a desperate attempt to gain control of the revolution and avoid complete anarchy in the streets, the leadership of the Russian parliament, the Duma, declared themselves the provisional government. Writes historian Stone, as soon as the Tsar's government collapsed, then power in Petrograd and soon in all of Russia was split between two contending bodies, the Soviets, which had formed themselves by the spontaneous acts of soldiers and civilians, which have much popular support but no formal legitimacy, and the provisional government, which, according to Stone, carried some legal authority from the Tsarist days but had at best tepid backing from most Russians. Neither commands the army, a million men under arms. That falls to the military command. The status of the Tsar is now not at all clear. Many generals in the army urge Tsar Nicholas to abdicate, but at this moment a century ago, Nicholas is not yet prepared to take this fateful step. And those are the headlines and the details of the fights that are breaking out in Russia in this week, 100 years ago.
Thanks. And that's Mike Schuster and the Great War Project. Now let's find out what's happening this week in the skies over Europe in today's War in the Sky segment. Teo, take it away.
Thanks, Teresa.
100 years ago this week, in the Great War in the Sky, we see a poignant example of the interplay between new technology and new military tactics, a theme that's repeated over and over and over again in this epic war. Last week, you met Baron von Zeppelin. This week, 100 years ago, on March 16th, the Germans try something that they think could be a game changer. But if, reasons the German Naval Airship Command, we could fly high above the capabilities of the British defenses, and then we could float over England and bomb them with impunity anytime we want, as often as we want. So they equip 5 Zeppelins to fly at what we would consider extreme high altitude. Think in terms of a mountain climber. High altitude is between 8,000 and 12,000 feet. It's really uncomfortable over 10,000 feet, and as a pilot, you start to think about oxygen right around there. Very high altitude is between 12,000 and 18,000 feet, and humans are not happy there at all. But at least 2 of the 5 Zeppelins climb up to between 17,000 and 19,000 feet. That's nearly 5,000 feet higher than the top of the Matterhorn. And consider this. Mountain climbers usually take days to weeks to slowly acclimate to those kinds of changes in altitude. So this is a pretty miserable experience. 3.5 miles in the sky, really thin air, and seriously cold. And of course, building a nice cozy fire under an extremely flammable gas bladder is not recommended practice. Think Hindenburg. Then there's the problem of dropping something from up there and hitting something down here. This is all stuff that nobody had figured out yet, so here's what happens. They mostly drop their bombs on open countryside, blow up some barns and probably some cows and sheep. No real damage and no one on the ground is killed. One Zeppelin, the L-39, has mechanical failures, drops down and drifts out over France, where anti-aircraft guns shoot her down with the loss of the entire crew. Another, the L-35, crashes on landing back in Germany. But the big boss, Peter Strasser, chief commander of the naval airships, has gone along for the ride in L-42, and the experiment leaves him convinced that this is an important new direction. He goes home to plan a new high-altitude bombing offensive for German Zeppelins in the Great War in the Sky 100 years ago this week. Be sure to check out R.G. Head's complete timeline of the War in the Sky on our website at www.ccc.org/warinthesky. Thank you.
This week, the Great War Channel has posted 3 new episodes. The first, Serbian Field Marshal Step Stepanovich, the first, Who Did What in World War I? The second, British India During World War I. And the third is Camouflage Patterns, Funerary Practices, and Prisoners Exchange. That's what's happening 100 years ago this week. Let's look at what's happening with the commemoration. It's time for World War I Centennial News now. First, we have some commission news. The famed Patrouille de France, or PAF, will perform in the skies over Kansas City as part of the national commemoration event on April 6, marking the 100-year anniversary of U.S. entry into war. This PAF show will be part of their 2017 USA tour to express gratitude for U.S. support to France during World War I. The PAF, or the Patrouille de France, is the Precision Aerobatic Demonstration Team of the French Air Force. If you love the Blue Angels, you're going to love them too. We have an update of the World War I POPPY program. Last week, the Veterans of Foreign Wars has officially partnered with the commission on this program. The VFW has long advocated for our veterans, and we thank them for helping us to raise awareness of the sacrifices made by our World War I vets. If you'd like to know more about the POPPY program, go to ww1cc.org/poppy. In our activities and events this week, we invite you to check out the Commission's event registry page. As the date of the centenary approaches, the states are beginning to come alive with World War I commemorative events. In fact, there are over 30 events happening nationwide in just the next 7 days. stop by the page and see if there's something happening near you. And you know, one event that seems to pop up around the nation are these special screenings of the upcoming PBS American Experience documentary entitled The Great War. Earlier this year, we had Carrie Phillips from PBS on the show to talk about how one can get a screening in your town. If you're interested, follow the link in the chat room and fill out a request form. Now let's see what's going on in the country with some updates from the states. The California World War I Centennial Task Force is now up and running. To talk more about it and what they're up to, we have Bill Benton, the co-director of the California World War I Centennial Task Force. Bill, can you tell us a little bit more about the task force and your plans for the upcoming centennial period?
Sure thing. As you know, California's had a rough start getting started here, and we're excited about things moving along. Each of our current committees that are in existence, we have the Northern Committee and the Southern Committee that are operating now with co-directors. We've got 11 co-directors on our managing board. And each of these is currently working to present April 6th events in the North with the help of Dr. Jonathan Roth at San Jose State University and Sal Compagno, president of the World War I Historical Association, which everyone should be familiar with. They're presenting putting a presentation together that's being planned for the Marine Memorial in San Francisco at 6 p.m. And then in the South, due to our stretched population, we're fortunate to be planning three events throughout the day. The first will be held at the historic Memorial Coliseum in Los Angeles. Start time there is planned for 1 o'clock. And then the second will be at the Veterans Home of California, West Los Angeles, lovingly referred to as the Old Soldiers Home in Santa Monica, with a start time planned for 4 p.m. Here we're excited that actor John Voight is expected to speak, and it should be a very interesting program there. The third is in the evening at 7 at the Claremont University's Mary Pickford Auditorium in Claremont. And there we're going to have a number of speakers and guests talking, authors, but we'll also be having a bell choir that's going to be playing music of the period. And so our hope is to get media attention at all of these events to springboard California's interest.
Okay, so what are you doing now in terms of getting the word out, and how can we find more about you?
Well, as you mentioned, we're excited about getting our website going and collecting great information and photos for that. We recently put together the exciting logo that you see there. Cortland Jindrup, one of our earlier volunteers, pointed out to us that the California is the only state that has its own distinctive shape sign for state highways, the spade of the gold miner of 1849. So that refers to both the First World War and also the westernmost road in the United States, the famous Coast Highway 1. With that, the state flower, the golden poppy on one side and the red poppy of Flanders on the other, were the most obvious requirements, and we're looking forward to getting involved with the poppy program. We've got Cortland involved with a memorial project at Elysian Park that is involved in the 100 Cities, 100 Memorials program, and we're planning for events past April the 6th, and there's some very interesting places here in California that are related to World War One that we want to accentuate and point to in the future and have folks know about.
Thank you, Bill. And that's Bill Benton, co-director of the California World War One Centennial Task Force. Now we'll take a broader look at the war with the International Report. In the UK, the headlines read, Belfast Project will explore Muslim contribution to First World War. The organizations British Future and New Horizons in British Islam are working with Queen's University and Northern Ireland historian Philip Orr to raise awareness among Belfast Muslim and Christian communities of their common World War I history. A total of 1.5 million soldiers from undivided India fought for Britain in the First World War. 400,000 of them Muslims from what is now Pakistan. Next in our spotlight in the media, let's take a look at an interesting program coming to a small screen near you. Harlem Hellfighters, the fact-based graphic novel by World War Z author Max Brooks, is getting the limited series treatment from History Channel. The Harlem Hellfighters graphic novel is based on the real-life story of U.S. Army's 369th Infantry Division, an African-American unit fighting in Europe during World War I. Jeremy Passmore and Andre Fabrizio, who wrote this earthquake adventure movie San Andreas, are on board to pen what is being developed as a six-hour series that will hail from A&E Studios in association with Overbrook Entertainment and Immersive Pictures. Next, we have some new posts and articles to bring to your attention. This week on the Commission site, you can find an interview with Dr. Matt Field. Dr. Field is from the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center in Washington, D.C. He is their Exhibits and Education Program Specialist and is curator of a year-long exhibit entitled Congress and the World Wars. The first part of the exhibit opened last Wednesday on March 8th and features Congress action during World War I and World War II. Their second exhibit, on display September 13, 2017 through March 5, 2018, will feature Congress's actions after the wars. Very few people think about Asia's involvement with the First World War. Recently, the Commission spoke with Dr. Noriko Kawamura about her recent presentation on Japan's role in World War I. She presented at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Kawamura is an associate professor of history at Washington State University. Her research focuses on the history of war, peace, and diplomacy in the Pacific world. There's a new post on our 100 Cities, 100 Memorials blog. This week, we are shining a light on a citizen in Cape May County, New Jersey, who wants to refurbish the local World War I memorial to commemorate the sacrifice of the local veterans who served a century ago. There are many projects like this one out there, and that's exactly why our $200,000 matching grant giveaway was created to help rescue ailing World War I memorials. Support your local memorials by telling people about this program. This week in our W. Wright blog, author Jerry Bell introduces the undiscovered richness of World War I Navy Yeoman First Class Marjorie Stoneman Douglas's life. Douglas was a prolific writer, naval servicewoman in World War I, and political activist, and she lived to be 108 years old. She's a 1912 graduate of Wellesley, and she married a con artist 30 years her senior and divorced him a year later when her father uncovered details of his financial fraud and forgery. Find out more about her life by reading the full post. Moving on, let's see what's going on in the world of social media this week. We have Catherine Akey with us. Catherine, what's going on our social media conversation wall?
Well, this week in social media, we've come across three stories that I'd really like to highlight for everybody. This past Monday was Canine Veterans Day. Now, several hundred thousand dogs served in the World War, many of which lost their lives in the process. So, of course, we had to give World War I's most famous pup, Sergeant Stubby, a shout out. In case you don't already know, there's actually a new feature film about Sergeant Stubby due to be released in April of 2018. If you want to learn more about that, you can find them on Facebook as Sergeant Stubby, an American Hero, or follow them on Instagram at the handle @StubbyMovie. Okay, the second story. It's still Women's History Month, and this week the New York Times put out an article about an exhibit in France, Mode FM 1418, which is up at the Bibliothèque Fournet in Paris's 4th arrondissement. The show, translating to Fashion and Women, 14 to 18, investigates women's clothing and the effect the Great War had on it. Now, if you can't make it to Paris, you can read more about the exhibit in the article, The Great War and Great Change for Women, by Rebecca Apple in the New York Times. Finally, we have a story from Cincinnati that warms our hearts here at the Commission. A high school social sciences teacher and his students searched for graves of African-American World War I veterans and soldiers in their area. They even had to resort to maps from the WPA to locate them, but once they did, They set about cleaning and restoring the graves that they found, many of which that had been long neglected. Acts like this embody what the Commission's all about: education, commemoration, participation, and we want to help support efforts like this. Just as Teresa mentioned earlier, if you or someone you know is involved in a restoration effort for a World War I monument or gravesite or something like that, please direct them to our 100 Cities, 100 Memorials project.
Thank you, Catherine. And if you're interested in seeing more social media posts, please visit our wall on our website. And it's ww1cc.org/social. Thank you all for joining us today. I'm Teresa Sims, and I'm signing out from the World War I Centennial Commission in Washington, D.C., and see you next week.
World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The video can be found at ww1cc.org/cn. Don't forget to sign up for our e-newsletter, The Weekly Dispatch. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are both at ww1cc, and we're on Facebook at ww1centennial. The podcast of World War I Centennial News can be found in the iTunes store, so you can enjoy the show anytime. Just subscribe. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to commemorate. So long.